Why don't we just start with just a moment of silence, just settling ourselves comfortably into being here now, wherever we've been and wherever we're going. None of that can happen. The only thing that can happen is this experience. And the more completely we relax into it and embrace it and pay attention to it, the more dynamic it will be for all of us. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. My topic tonight is freedom, which is a pretty broad-based topic. Does anyone have anything in particular that you'd like to hear me talk about tonight on this topic? You're probably not going to help me out. You tend not to, but I'll ask anyway. You're usually pretty lousy when I ask this question. I'm talking collectively to the room, not to you specifically. Does anyone have anything in particular they'd like to hear?
Consciousness book.
Yeah.
So maybe that might be sort of relevant to tonight.
Yeah, that's actually that's a good question. Thank you. He's talking about Titiksha, I'm not sure how it's pronounced actually, which is basically the ability to endure external conditions and not be affected by them, to be tough. He told the story particularly about riding in the open back of a truck on a cool winter night and taking off their shirts, the young men, and trying to just be strong in the light of that. The most extreme example of that is the Tibetan monks who can go out and sleep in the snow and melt the snow around them because they can generate so much heat within themselves. But yes, that's actually, it's a very good topic for tonight. Anything else? Yes, Ivan? No, he quoted Mark Twain.
Oh.
Smoking is the easiest habit in the world to give up. I've done it myself dozens of times.
So that we have something in the background that we do give up. The past sort of doesn't matter. That's what we know in the future.
Uh-huh.
Any context of that?
Okay. All right. Well, you are actually, I insulted you and now you're proving me wrong. Anything else? Okay. There'll be a chance to ask. Hello. There'll be a chance to ask questions if you have them too, so we can go then. The topic tonight was chosen because it's the 4th of July, but almost the 4th of July. But the whole idea of freedom is actually an extremely interesting spiritual concept. Many of you I know, and several of you seem to know Swami Kriyananda too, but just to give you the context, Paramhansa Yogananda, author of this book, was one of the first great spiritual masters to make his life and work in America. In fact, he was the first. He came in 1920 from India when he was himself in his 20s, and he lived in America until he died in 1952. Los Angeles was his primary place of residence after he finished traveling back and forth across the country, which he did for many years. This man, Swami Kriyananda, whom several of you have referred to, is an American man, and he was old enough to be Yogananda's direct disciple. In 1948, Kriyananda was 22. He read Autobiography of a Yogi, which had been published 2 years earlier. He was immediately absolutely magnetized by Yogananda, traveled from New York to Los Angeles, and at the first meeting became a disciple and a monk. And that was his life ever thereafter for the next 60 years. I met Kriyananda myself when I was 22 in 1969. He was speaking, as it happened, right here at Stanford University. And I'll relate that. I'll tell you more about that meeting because it relates a lot to our topic of freedom. And when I met Swami Kriyananda, I was instantly magnetized. I just really knew that I was looking at my destiny, you might say. I was looking at the person who was going to teach me what I wanted to know. I'd never met anyone I thought could. And from that day until this moment, I've really done nothing else. It was close to Thanksgiving in 1969. That was just an absolutely defining moment. I made a very fast decision, which I've stuck to all this time. It would have been impulsive, except after 45 years, you can hardly call it impulsive. It looks like it's turned into a life. Swamiji left this plane of existence a little more than a year ago, at the April 20th of 2013. So we're all just getting used to it, because he was a very involved, very communicating, very accessible person. So his absence is notable. It's just beginning to dawn on us because he traveled around the world a lot, so many months would pass and you wouldn't see him. But now it's beginning to get longer than that would have been. But in the way of these souls, their physical absence is not their absence. So everything that I'm going to share with you is based on Yogananda's teachings as I learned them from Kriyananda. I'm not making this up. I believe it all from my own experience now, but not everything I say is my own experience. Some of it is what I've been told, and I make that very clear because I don't want to pretend to be more than I am. Now to the subject of freedom, because freedom is a really great subject. I've often shared with those of you who've heard me speak before that I have considered myself to be an intense truth seeker from an extremely young age. But I really did not have words for what I was searching for. I used the word happy, because happy is the word that we do get. And I knew that I was keen on finding a way to live that would ensure happiness. I wasn't so much in search of happiness because I didn't feel like I didn't have it. But I wanted a way of life that was based on happiness as the primary value. And growing up as I did, I was born in 1947, so through those years, we didn't have as many resources beyond the narrow confines of whatever culture in this country you were born and grew up in. So nobody was really talking to me about the search for meaning. That didn't really get popular really until the hippie era broke. And I was an early adapter in that lifestyle. I went right out there. Was really happy to see an alternative and seized it with both hands for a period of time. But the expectation of a person of my education and my cultural and intellectual context was simply that I would, follow through my education as far as I could, have some highly educated profession, and then essentially replicate the life of my parents. I'd find a house and a husband and a home and a dog and a station wagon and multiples of children, and all of these things would happen. And it was just, that was just what was expected of me. Everybody always talked about the things that I felt were important as if they would be a byproduct of that lifestyle. And no one ever talked to me about qualities of consciousness as a goal in themselves, if you understand the difference. Nobody really talked about qualities of consciousness at all until the hippies and the drugs hit, and then the word consciousness suddenly became like a big story. That once I got that word, which I got that word from that movement, I really got that that was exactly what I was looking for that whole time. Because I could tell that what you were doing in your life was only meaningful to you in terms of how you actually experienced it. That there was nothing inherent in any particular way of life that was going to give you what you wanted. It was only a question of how you experienced it. And that's when I finally got the word consciousness, I began to understand that. If you change your consciousness, then everything changes. And I didn't know about saints, I didn't know about masters, I didn't know about self-realization when I was small, or even not, well, by the time I got the word consciousness, it was all breaking in America, and I was an early adapter. As I said, I was right out there at the front of the wave on those things. But because I wasn't unhappy, and because I wanted to make happiness the basis, but I realized later, and these words came to me later, that what I felt in my childhood and my adolescence, the word that I finally came up with was confined. I felt intensely confined. And my parents were lovely. My home was, you know, privileged, not highly privileged, but comfortable, certainly. But I realized that I had a sense of confinement, and that confinement emanated from within me. I felt extremely small. I felt very cramped. Afterwards, I put these words on it. My first way of breaking that confinement was that I thought I would have children. I thought I would have lots of children, you know, large, you know, vast numbers of children. I'd never thought the mechanics or the money out all that well, but I just thought if I had a big brood of children, I would be bigger and therefore less confined. And this is the logic of youth. But one day it occurred to me that even if I had seven children, it still would only be seven, that there would still be a very definable edge to that, and the confinement that I was feeling was, I began to realize, was metaphysical and not physical. I also, it occurred to me that merely giving birth to children would not actually change my consciousness. It would make me physically a mother, but it wouldn't necessarily make me a better person. And that was sort of we fall into these traps. These are the unexamined life, where you just fall, you follow these patterns. You will get your PhD, you will become a professor, you will get married, you will have children. And there's a vague feeling about what all of that's going to give you, but one doesn't really stop and think clearly about what this is actually going to mean. So I lived my life until I was 18. I was perfectly well-adjusted. I did fine. But I always felt like I was just standing on the edge of everybody else's world. And I could never clearly make sense out of what they were doing. I just couldn't feel it. And it, yes, every adolescent feels awkward. But I realized this was, as I look back, it was much more than that. I just thought they had to have a deeper purpose. And maybe they were just telling me. Maybe I just wasn't old enough. I was much older before I realized that people simply weren't thinking. They were just rolling with the flow and replicating what they'd seen as children, and they were just doing it again. And then sometimes later you would stop and think, who am I? Why am I here? First, I was given books about self-realization, actually from East-West, except it was up in Menlo Park then. This store has been an integral part of my life since the very beginning, because it was the only source in the whole, virtually in the country, and certainly in the area, for that kind of learning. But it wasn't until I met Swami Kriyananda, and he was 44 years old, when he walked into the, was a tent actually on the Stanford campus. And I didn't know exactly what I was looking at, but what I was looking at was freedom. I was just looking at freedom in a person, and I felt it. I was looking at freedom, and the corollary of that freedom was joy. And my first thought when he walked into the room was not a reasoned one. It was really simple. He has what I want. That's exactly what I said to myself. I didn't say it out loud, but it just flashed in my mind. He has what I want. And I'd never seen it personified. I didn't even, you know, clearly know that it existed. I just knew that I didn't have what I wanted, and I had begun to study enough metaphysics to understand slightly of what it was I was looking for, but it was hard to imagine until I saw it. And truthfully, I have spent the rest of my life trying to understand how he does it and to replicate as much of it in my own small sphere, which by contrast is a teacup, as much as I can by bringing those same principles into it. When I met him, I was it was a largish room. Well, it was a moderate-sized room. I was as far away from him in the back row as I could have been. He was on one end, and I was at the other. And part of the way his freedom expressed to me was that I felt that there was no edge to his energy. You know, most people's energy just reaches you from a certain distance, and if you're too far away, you can't, you're not really in touch with them. But he walked into the room, and I was as far away from him as I could have been, and I felt like he was talking to me right here. It's like the part of that freedom was that the outline of his body was no barrier to his consciousness. And of course, all of these things have, as I've studied these teachings much more deeply, I can put very complicated and very detailed metaphysical explanations on these things. But the explanations came after, the experience came first. So now we have to ask ourselves if we care, and because you're sitting here, I presume you care at least a little, sort of what is it, what is freedom, why would we want it, how do we go about getting it, can it be done? I started with the story of Swami Kriyananda partly because that's where my faith and my commitment comes from. Because until then, it was kind of a confused theory in my mind. In fact, until I met him, I was becoming quietly and increasingly desperate, is the only word I can use. Because I had all the theory, and I just couldn't figure out how on earth he put it into practice, because I'd never seen it. So it was very reassuring. Now, what all the scriptures talk about, and what the whole spiritual teaching is that all of us as human beings, we're made essentially the same, although we're just sparklingly different. I'm looking at all your faces, and we're just sparklingly different right in this room of ages and orientations and life experience. And I've been increasingly fascinated, and it's just amazing to contemplate that each one of us is completely real unto himself. Does that make sense? And of course, naturally, I know myself, and I live with myself all the time, and I have a whole context in which I live. But it's fascinating to me that so do each one of you. I mean, of course, I don't mean to sound patronizing or silly, but you can walk around this planet, and every single human being, even though we're fundamentally built the same, with the same essential needs and operating systems, so to speak, but each of us has completely individualized that reality. Individualized it with countless incarnations before, countless experiences before, a whole trajectory of destiny that's in front of us. My parents passed away in their 83, 84 years old, and when their lives began to become difficult, as some people's do, my mother was deteriorating physically, my father started deteriorating mentally. I became, at the beginning of that cycle, exceedingly anxious, just very, very anxious about what was happening for them. Anxious in the sense that I felt that I had some duty as their daughter and as a person of creative willpower to fix it. And the ailments were incurable. My mother had Parkinson's. There was nothing that could be done about it. But I felt this overwhelming necessity to redirect their karma, to change their destiny and make their destiny something else. Now, of course, that's a ridiculous idea. It took me longer than you might think to figure out that that was a ridiculous plan. But what happened to me was I was so... I became so concerned that I forgot to look and see that these are separate individuals who are following their own destiny. And I just pretended they were me and that what was happening to them did not feel right to me. It didn't feel natural to me. And then one day I woke up and I realized, I think I'll quote from the Bible, when Jesus, before he was crucified, which was a rather big event, not only in his own life, but in the history of the world, and so he says very dramatically, Lord, save me from this hour, but then he adds, but for this hour was I born. And, you know, you get the big movie screen version of that, and the thunderclaps, and the angels, and all of those things happen, and you hear him say it. But what's fascinating about that, you see, is that every one of us can and actually should say exactly that same thing for exactly where you're standing right now. Because, factoring in reincarnation, we've had many, many lifetimes. And in every lifetime has been just as real as this one is to us. Merely because we can't remember them doesn't mean that we didn't remember them when they were happening. And in each one, the intensity of all our feelings was just as vivid as it is to us now. The anguish of loss, the joy of success, the struggle of old age, the fight against illness, the effort to make a living, the satisfaction of everything. I mean, everything that's real to you now has always been real to you every time you've done it, every time we've done it. And all of those accumulated experiences registering in the chakras, which is a whole other conversation, manifest themselves finally right here, right now. And everything that we've ever learned is coming right to a focus right at this minute, and we have the same opportunity that we will always have to make a choice that will lead us to ever greater happiness, or not, as we prefer, for this hour where we all born. Exactly. And most of us, I mean, you know, when people go to psychics, and it always used to be a joke that you always were told that you were somebody famous. You know, you were told you were this queen or that general, and you were rarely told that you ran a little tea shop for a while, and then you retired and raised rabbits. You know, it's just like, this is really not what you want to hear. But looking around, the likelihood is that we all did a lot of that. I mean, looking around the planet, you can see there are many more of those than there are queens of England. But it, just a moment, I lost the thread there. Let me find it for a minute. But in each lifetime, no matter what it was, we were always striving with the same longing, because everybody has the same longing. Everybody wants to be loved. Everybody wants to be able to give love. People want to be understood, want to be appreciated, want to be comforted when we're sad. We want to serve others, to feel that somehow my cycle here has not been in vain, that it matters. And then simultaneously, we're always, whether we realize it or not, we're always on this great journey of consciousness, because in the end, consciousness is all that matters. Yogananda put it so simply. He said, it doesn't matter what happens to you in your life. The only thing that matters is what you become through what happens to you. We think that the rules of the game are, you know, success, money, recognition. Usually we think that the best is if it's easy, if it's not too many challenges, that we don't suffer much, that that's good. But from the point of view of the infinite, God really doesn't much care about the little stuff, which is why a lot of the time when we pray, we don't get answers. You know, am I really supposed to take this promotion, or should I go into the other department? And we pray and pray, and we don't really get an answer. Should I buy the house at the corner, or should I buy the house in the middle of the street? You know, I have two children. Should I have a third? We think that's a big question. But from the divine point of view, who are really looking at this on a very long rhythm, Paramahansa Yogananda said that he remembers the cycle of reincarnation all the way back to the point when his own individual spark of consciousness, the word for it in Sanskrit is jiva, when the jiva, which eventually became a self-realized master, was a diamond, to the level of a diamond. He remembers his own evolution from a diamond all the way to becoming a self-realized master. I mean, my mind just goes on tilt. I don't know where to put that. A friend of mine, fascinated by that, asked me, how long does it take to get out of being a diamond? And then what happens next? Is an emerald more evolved than a diamond? What do you do at that point? I thought that was a great question. And at that time, I would often have informal opportunities to talk with Swami Kriyananda. So I said, okay, I'll ask him. So as it happened, he was living in Los Angeles for a time, and I was sitting at his breakfast table, and we're just making light conversation. I asked him this question. How long did it take him to get out of being a diamond? Swami looked at me and he said, that is a really stupid question. Meaning, what would you do with that answer? I mean, what difference does it make? But he said that good-natured, that he wasn't really trying to discipline me. And I responded by saying, I thought it was an extremely interesting question, Swamiji. And he kind of, you know, looked over and wasn't going to answer me. But very often with him, he'll either make a joke or something, and then he'll answer seriously. But he answered seriously, perfect answer. Compared to eternity, any other unit of time is meaningless. So we think, from our perspective, because we've been dragging through, you know, a long dry winter, and maybe it's even been a long 3 days for us, our little units of time, it all seems large. But compared to eternity, it's a fascinating way to look at it, isn't it? And everything has to be compared to eternity. When, toward the end of Swamiji's life, he actually had a lot of physical karma all through his life. But in the last years, well, the last years were not different than other years, but he was going through some cycle of not feeling so well, and we were just walking along outside, and I said, how are you feeling, sir? He said, compared to eternity, just fine. So I was like, why not? Why not compare it to that? And so thinking in terms of, for this hour were we born, what we're really doing here, it doesn't matter what happens to us. The only thing that matters is what we become through what happens to us. And if we really want super conscious and divine guidance in what we do, we have to ask a question for which there is a super conscious answer. That is, how can I open my heart? How can I be more compassionate? How can I be of greater service? How can I have deeper communion with the divine? How can I overcome the meannesses of my own heart and live more in the power of the infinite reality? Now, those questions have divine answers, because that's really the reason that we're here. So taking this all the way back to my parents, I saw my mother beginning to decline with Parkinson's and entering in what turned out to be a really great, fabulous experience for her. Which is she'd never really had to develop her, she never really did develop her willpower all that much. But when she was constantly having to struggle against her declining physical body, and as she put it, which is of course the motto of older people anyway, but especially ill, you know, once I give it up, I don't get it back. So she just struggled constantly to maintain her mobility and everything that you would try to work with a disease that gradually takes it all away from you. She became, you know, a much more powerful person. And I know in her next lifetime, whatever that's going to be, she's going to start way ahead because of that experience. Now, I'm watching her, and my karma was not to have Parkinson's. My mother was approximately my age when she got it, and there's no sign of it in me, and I don't expect to get it. If I do, I do, but that's not, but especially, you know, those years ago when she got ill, it wasn't my karma to have that. It was hers. But I kept not being able to see her sufficiently as separate from myself to realize, oh, for this hour was she born at first. But then I finally realized this. Oh, this is my mother's golden opportunity to see what she will become from what happens to her. So instead of feeling, as I had been feeling, that I had some obligation to take this opportunity away from her, I mean, how was I going to do that anyway? But you can certainly run around and make a lot of dust, imagining that you can change someone's destiny and wear yourself out and annoy everyone in the process, which is what I was doing, basically, until I finally realized, oh, no, this is what she needs. And her soul is happy. She's been working for how many incarnations? Millions of incarnations. Just to get right here. To be my mother in Southern California in her mid-60s with the beginning of Parkinson's. What a fabulous opportunity for her. And as it turned out, it was. And then all of a sudden, I tried to help her become who she needed to become through the experience instead of trying to take it away from her. Now, we're talking about freedom. All of us are just confined, just exactly as I was saying I did feel before. I can't say that I'm in any way free, but I'm freer than I used to be. We're confined. We start out being confined by, once you have one body, it's the only one you have. And even though our true nature is that we are just a little spark of the infinite and that we exist simultaneously in eternity, nonetheless, we have decided, or rather more accurately, our karma has compelled us to take an incarnation. I certainly don't remember choosing to be conceived, but I have understood enough, and we've even had these, you know, death and return accounts that are just so many of them, and you can, of course, read it in the scripture, that the soul very consciously moves through this journey. It moves in and out of physical bodies, goes into the astral universe and enjoys the astral qualities for a while, and then your karma, your material karma, makes you restless, and here you are. Just like we get restless for anything else. I'm sitting at home, and I open the refrigerator, and it's full of all these fabulous organic vegetables that we just got from this Ananda farm that we just started growing things on. It's wonderful. And all of a sudden, I have a hankering for Mexican food, and I'm out the door. Everything I need is right there. But that there's a restlessness in me that makes me go and do something else. I mean, you've all, and I'm looking at all the work on my desk, and suddenly it seems urgent that I call my girlfriend and we go out to breakfast, and I make up a whole reason why that's just so important to do right at that moment. Everything is there, but we get diverted by restlessness, by longing. And we also get diverted by regret, is what Swami called it, which is regret is a very inclusive term for everything that makes us sad in one way or another. Whatever didn't happen, we try to go and make it happen, or we're disturbed by the fact that it didn't happen the way we hoped it would happen. Right? Our child died before he could have a success. Our child turned out to be more of a lemon than we had hoped. And never really had the success that we wanted, whatever it might be. Two friends of mine were having a lot of difficulty with their son. And they came to Swamiji and they were just sort of asking him for help and advice. And they explained just what a difficult child he was. And he was so self-concerned and he just didn't seem to have... It was a very hard situation. And Swamiji just looked at them and the first thing he said was, well, you know, he said this very seriously and with compassion, but very bluntly. Well, he said, sometimes you just have to accept the fact that you got a lemon. Just like that. I mean, we think we make our children. We don't make them. We make the vehicle through which their destiny can be expressed. As Swamiji said, every soul has its own destiny, but the parents don't make the soul or the destiny. They just create a physical body through which that can express. And you really don't know in the great wide universe who's coming to you. There are things you can do. There's principles of conscious conception where you can actually try to draw someone that is more deeply in tune by focusing your energy. But otherwise, people don't want to admit it, but you don't know who you're getting at all. So he said, maybe you got a lemon. And they were just, you know, horrified. And just stared at him for a couple of minutes, and then he said, for a few seconds only, but then he said, but I don't think so, and then proceeded to give them other advice. But sometimes it's a good idea just to stop and think, maybe I did. You know, just because I think of myself as such a great parent doesn't mean that I didn't give a home to a soul whose destiny is going to be very different than I want it to be. I do not create either the soul or his destiny. But what it is that what I was saying before is that we incarnate in these physical bodies and we're drawn from the realm where we go between physical bodies by longing and regret. We long for many things or we regret things and we want to try to make it right. That's what moves us every day anyway. So the pattern that we see acted out in the world that we can perceive with the senses and understand with the mind is exactly the same, no matter how subtle it gets. It just gets more subtle. And we have to understand it with different tools of knowing. But the same rules apply. But we are bound by all that longing and all that regret. And that pulls us into this one body. And I was starting to say, once you have this one body, all of the unfinished business of all those incarnations is just right there with you. And even though we don't remember it, and we may think it was a long time ago, if it's unfinished in your heart, it's just unfinished. And it just remains there. I had a very interesting experience when I was meditating. I'd been in seclusion for a number of days, and so I was much quieter and just, you know, more really into that inner world than is sometimes easily done when I'm so involved in the outer world. And often in meditation, the idea of one offering one's spirit into the light is a common practice. It's a lovely practice. And I was meditating, and I was using that to help deepen my meditation. And then it occurred to me suddenly that instead of merely offering into the light, I remembered what it says in the Bible, as many as received him, speaking of Christ, to them gave he, Jesus gave to them, the power to become as he was. That's a very subtle statement about the guru-disciple relationship, really, that the guru can liberate the disciple from all his karma, all that holds him. The true guru can make every disciple a guru, is what it really means. So I thought, I'll reverse it. I'll try to allow the energy to come into me instead of sending my energy out. And I thought of God as Divine Mother because I find that to be a very approachable way to feel it. And I could feel the love of the infinite coming into me, and then I could literally feel, almost like a physical thing, that it could only come in so far because there was a stopping point within me. There was a point at which my heart, my consciousness, ceased to be permeable because I wasn't, because the vibrations of my heart did not match the vibrations of Divine Mother's love. If you think of vibrations as being able to, if they're the same, they'll blend together. Think of just a choir, people singing when they're singing in harmony. If the two voices are right on the same pitch together, they'll just go together and this extraordinary thing happens. But when they're a little dissonant from each other, especially if the dissonance is not deliberate, you know, instead they can't merge and the energy is all broken. Well, our relationship to the greater reality in which we swim at all times, whether we call that God, Divine Mother, Guru, whatever, Lord Shiva, whatever you want to call it, it's a certain vibration of consciousness. And it's a more subtle vibration than the material plane. And the extent to which we are able to match that vibration, to that extent we receive it. That's exactly what St. John meant. As many as received him, as many as attuned their vibration to his, then those vibrations could merge. And the only thing that prevented that merging was not the divine intention, but our capacity to receive it. So I'm sitting here in my little mountain cabin having my little experience, and I can feel that Divine Mother loves me, which is a very nice thing to feel. But I feel that she could only love me as much as I let her. And what was fascinating to me is I could feel what was stopping her. And it was the accumulated, I want to say leftovers, debris, of disappointment, resentment, anger, sadness. Just, and it wasn't like from this lifetime, because I'm a complicated person. I would be not telling you the truth if I said I wasn't. But my life is pretty straightforward. I don't have a lot of very complicated relationships going on right now. But I have had lots of them in lots of incarnations. And what I have going on in the present is all from the past, is another way of putting it. But I could just feel it. It was just there. And I can remember past lives, some of them. I can remember past experiences because I can see it in what goes on around me. You know, I can see where some difficulties come from. I don't want to exaggerate that, but that's not that hard to do once you think that way. I'm still upset about this. I still want so-and-so to apologize to me about that. How could they ever have treated me that way? Why didn't they recognize what I really did? How could they have misunderstood me? Maybe you can make the list from the day you were born until now. It all just hangs out in there. And the degree to which we are holding longing and regret, whether we're conscious of it or not, is the limit on our freedom. Because we're always going to have to be moving through this world trying to make those things right. Trying to get people to respond to us in a certain way, or get them to hear how sorry we are, or just kind of keep it running. That was what was amazing to me. I was just sitting there in this particular experience. I was thinking, wow, look at this. I'm still just holding on to this stuff. You know, how long ago did some of this happen? And some of it I knew, I could identify it and I could feel. You know, this is literally centuries ago. But now think about it. Once you get your feelings hurt and they don't apologize to you, how many people die? How many times have all of us died? I mean, we're all walking around with these unfinished karmas, aren't we? And what they're doing is they're just vibrating. And they're saying, what about me? What about me? What about taking care of me? And so we have incarnated into a form. We have identified deeply with this particular one. And we're just holding ourselves separate. We're holding ourselves separate from other people. We're holding ourselves separate from the greater reality in which we live. Now, to go back to my first meeting with Swami Kriyananda, which was confirmed by the next four decades of close association with him, he didn't carry stuff like that. He had lots and lots of tough experiences in his life. The people he loved the most in the world turned against him in his early 30s and stayed against him till the day he died, and did the very best they could do to just nullify and destroy his reputation and make everything that we were doing invalid. These things happen in spiritual work. They always do. You know, Jesus himself was crucified. Every spiritual work in the world is always tested that way. So, he never reconciled. There was never any reconciliation. But he did not allow himself to be bound by the things that happened to him. They happened to him, but his concern was only what he became through what happened to him. And to himself, I tell a lot of these stories in this book I wrote, but in one case, I was essentially saying, how can you be so charitable toward people who are so uncharitable toward you? He says, and his answer was very simple. If I was not charitable, he said, I would lose twice. First, I lose their affection for me, but then if I allow myself to become bitter, bound, negative toward them, then not only do I not have their affection, but I also have encased myself in a vibration that walls me off and forces me to make a whole lot of other decisions I really don't want to make. Now, I mean, haven't we all found ourselves just suddenly saying something that we didn't really want to say? You know, I've been married for 30 years, and most of the time I have a very harmonious relationship with my husband, but every so often, now, I don't know who I'm talking to in this room exactly, so, but it has been my experience that almost every marriage has, like, the argument, the point of disagreement that will never, ever, ever be resolved. I once was so stupid in a couples retreat that I actually invited the couples to approach the insoluble argument and try to solve it. I mean, what? It's just like temporary insanity. The whole room just completely went to pieces, and it took me a full hour to just get it back because every couple just went right into that. Couldn't ever get out of it, and we had to work really hard to distract everybody and get them back. Okay. But, you know, after many years, you decide it's not worth it. Fundamentally, if you're going to get along together, you just decide it's not worth it. But every so often, you fall into it. I'm amazed when I even touch it. You know, whenever I get close to it, doesn't happen very often. I want to just get clear in my own head when I'm talking. But it just, you know, the why doesn't he behave more exactly like I want him to space. For me, that's the issue. I, of course, am right about everything. And occasionally he just perseveres in this independent thinking, and I just can't understand why. There was apparently in the Mideast, there was a political candidate, this is true, who was a political candidate, and he was actually, I don't even remember who he was or what country even, but he was running on a platform of rights for women. And it was very radical, of course. I don't know if he won or lost. And some reporters were talking to him, and they were saying, well, this sounds good because you're trying to get elected, but certainly in your own home you must have the last word. And the man said, oh, yes, I always have the last word in my own home. Anything you want, dear. But in any case, what surprises me, and what is the point here, is that even after all the work that I've done, you know, as intensely as I try to be conscious, I'm amazed what'll happen. And you think, where does that come from? And why would I still do that? And all, that's the limit of our freedom, is that we're not able to choose our response. We are compelled by all that we're holding, that in those moments, something that we're holding just flashes out. Swami Kriyananda always chose his response. I never saw him, ever. And I saw him in all sorts of circumstances, you know, being hailed by thousands of people as the greatest spiritual teacher in the world, being vilified by in a courtroom by horrible lawyers, and having just everything that you could imagine, and just petty-minded people or people falling at his feet. When he was in India, literally, they would have to make a corridor like this, because the Indian belief is that if you can just touch the feet of a holy person, your whole life will be changed. So people would be crowding in with their children, and I mean, he barely couldn't get out of an auditorium. And those people lined up. It was all sort of work. They'd line up just so he could get out. Because he was elderly, and he just too easy for him to trip over all those people and hurt himself. But I saw all sides of it. But at all times, he was free to choose his response. And his response was always chosen in terms of what would uplift the energy, what would help people. Now, that doesn't mean he was always sweet, because sometimes what would uplift the energy is that someone really needed to hear the truth, and they needed to hear it right now, and they needed to hear it in unequivocal terms. One time he said, there was a man in our community at that time who, he was a little immature, which frankly all of us were a little immature at that time, but he seemed to be a little more willful than others, and his personality was not as pleasing as some, and he just annoyed us all. But we were all working on our own evolution, and therefore it was not part of the culture to be able to just say, you're such an annoying twerp, would you please get out of our lives? We have this, the band is called Guru Bhais, your brothers and sisters in the Guru, and it's worse than marriage, because marriage at least ends when you die, but Guru Bhais just goes on for incarnations, so it doesn't serve you. You have to learn to get along. You have to learn to love everyone, and Guru Bhais is where you practice. But I'm joking with all of this when I say it's worse than marriage, although a woman friend of mine, she was married for 60 years. She didn't have any belief in the afterlife, anything like that. She was a noble, honorable person, but just didn't have any spiritual context. But she volunteered at a hospital where some of the nurses were nuns. And when her husband of 60 years died, one of the nuns tried to comfort her by saying, don't worry, dear, you'll see him again. She was just so forthright. She said, I think 60 years was quite long enough. This man was just a little bit, he could have had a better manner. Swami had a marvelous phrase. He would say such and so, yes, so and so does have an unfortunate manner. That's how he would describe it. He does have an unfortunate manner. I mean, he has an obnoxious personality. That's how anybody else would say it. But Swami would just say, he has an unfortunate manner, which was telling the truth, but telling it in such a supportive way that, yeah, he does have an unfortunate manner, and let's see if we can help him to have a better manner. But it doesn't have anything to do with him. He's a spark of the divine like everyone else. He just has an unfortunate way of expressing it. So Swamiji, finally, this man had done whatever he had done that time. And Swami just said very emphatically to a small group of us, you know, really, he just said, I really don't think it can go on like this. He really needs to, you know, he needs to understand, which was simply true. And Swami said, you know, I need to correct him. And we were just like so happy. We were so eager for Swami to correct him because he was annoying us all. And Swami did. He kept it in mind. And I had the opportunity to observe Swamiji very closely. And I saw many occasions in which this same man would run his little story. And I would watch Swami, like, consider. And he finally did speak up. And he spoke up extremely strongly. And it was 10 years later. Really, 10 years. Because he always was free to decide. And he felt that the man just wasn't receptive. He wasn't going to hear it. And what good would it do? You see, we're always thinking about what I need. And a person who is truly free has no stake in it. And the only thing they're really interested in is, will this help? Will this help? Will this be helpful? It's an amazing thing to think. Is this actually going to help someone? Because we think, well, I've always been clever with words, and one of my girlfriends put me straight really early. Not that I really listened as closely as I should have, but eventually I heard her. She said, "My dear Asha, you explain my problems more clearly than I want to know them." She said it to me. And then I thought to myself, who am I serving by doing that? Just being able to sit there and analyze and say what she does right and wrong. Who am I serving? This is not helping her. This is not a free choice. This is the compulsion of my egoic habit, my intellectual pride, my complete misunderstanding about how people actually change. Thinking that a frontal assault and an intellectual explanation actually enables people to change. When I was first beginning to do the work I'm doing now, and I was living at Ananda Village, which is our country community about 4 hours from here, I was married to David at that time, although we had just gotten married, and I was setting up lecture tours. I just came from Nevada City, and I would go through Sacramento, San Francisco, and Palo Alto, actually, now that I think about it. But I had to set those tours up, and I had to make a lot of decisions. You know, you're working far in advance, and I was at that time, still am a little, but especially then, I was a terrible procrastinator. And I also, I always like to calculate my own advantage in every situation, so I didn't like to commit too far in advance, because what if I got a better offer? Maybe what if something else was going to be more fun? I didn't want to already be committed. So I kept postponing having to decide. My husband has none of those faults. He's very, very honorable and very dutiful, just very mixed decisions, just like this. It has to be decidable, just decide it. He doesn't fret like I would fret. So he could only imagine that the only reason I was procrastinating is because I didn't understand the jeopardy that I was creating of just getting all backed up, of losing my venues, just, you know, so much bad could happen. So he tried to help me by telling me all the terrible things that were going to befall me if I didn't get my act together, which was not exactly reading the psychology of the individual properly, because my actual procrastination was based on fear. I was just anxious. What if I, you know, what if this isn't going to work out? What if this? What if, I mean, I joke about a better offer, but what if really something better comes? So for him just to lay the fear on thicker was not going to give me the decisive courage that I needed. Fortunately, I had enough awareness to just say, you know, honey, I know that. What I need you to do is I need you to put your arm around me and say, there, there, dear, it's fine. It's going to all be all right. You know, and he did exactly that. There, there, it's going to be just fine. And as soon as I felt safe and comforted and affirmed, then I just could go and make the decisions. But you see how much it takes to be able to stand back enough from your own reality to really understand that your son really doesn't want to be a banker. He really is going to study theater, and he's going to become a set designer. And you're right, he may not eat for the first 20 years of his life, and you may have him in your living room for that whole period of time, but he's not you. And when you're acting because you're afraid, he's not stupid. He can tell it's not about him. He can tell it's all about you. Everybody can tell. And what do we want? We want to be perfect instruments. We want to love each other the way God loves us. And it's an amazing meditation to really contemplate total acceptance. Now, don't misunderstand. People try to get total acceptance by just declaring that whatever I am is just perfect. Swamiji was out in the 70s. There was a lot of, sort of romantic hoo-ha about spiritual teaching, much of which was really flash in the pan, just people guessing, is what I would say. Not real masters offering truth, but just people guessing. They were talking about the hill they were standing on, but they just didn't know how many hills there were behind that one. And the love yourself just as you are, you're perfect just as you are, you're absolutely lovable just as you are, was very popular. And so Swami was at some big conference and everybody was being guided to love themselves just as the way they are. Put their arms around you and give yourself a big hug and just say, I am perfect, I am wonderful, I am lovable. And Swami stood up and he said, I don't know why you would love yourself just as you are. There's so much about you that's not lovable. Just like, of course you're not. Who do you think you're fooling? Because we all know that. We all know. I mean, it's a seed of truth. But it's different levels. It's different levels. And this one is completely bound by all these selfish considerations. And we just have to go inch by inch by inch. For this hour was I born. In this moment, when the pressure's on, and we can't make that full leap. We can't go all the way to Christ-like forgiveness. I couldn't have waited 10 years. And in fact, with that particular individual who was so annoying, I told him quite strongly what I thought he ought to do. Didn't work out very well. Let me just put it that way. He actually ran right to Swami Kriyananda and suggested that I should be fired from any position that allowed me to ever counsel, teach anybody because I was so clearly incompetent. And then when Swami told me what he had reported, the first thing I said was, well, I resign. I don't want to have anything to do with this anymore. And then I said, you know, I didn't say any of that, actually. He just heard it that way, but that's not really what I said. And then I said, but sir, what I said was completely true. He said, yes, he said, but Swami said to me, he said, I know. He said, but it wasn't, he didn't want to hear it. And I'm like, who am I serving? Same question. So we have to just constantly, in every situation, ask, how can I add? How can I add that which is needed? And sometimes what's needed, and as I say, it's important to understand that, is that you just plant your feet and fold your arms and say, you know, I have had it with you, just get out of my life. Sometimes what's needed is hard truth, you know, strong medicine. Sometimes, and sometimes what's needed from you is strong medicine. It's not like, this is not about being nice. This is about being able to choose what the right response is. That's freedom, is to be able to choose. I started out this incarnation, I was going to be a monastic my whole life, and then my husband came on the scene, and he was just so adorable, that was the end of that plan. You know, now we've become sannyasis again, the blue that you always see me in is a mark of a certain initiation, but we haven't had to renounce our marriage to do this, so we're doing it together. I'd be perfectly happy to be married to him 100 more lifetimes, it's been a great story, but I'd rather choose it more freely than I chose it this time. This time it was like no choice. There was just no choice. I was so compelled, absolutely compelled, just by everything. I just really couldn't imagine life without him, and that was that. And I mean, I had to say to God, I hope this is your will because we really don't have any choice in this matter. It was simply beyond me to take another course at that point. And it's worked out well, and I'm happy for that, and I'm not ashamed of who I am, meaning I can't be better than I am. But I would like to always be able to choose. Always be able to choose. And then you're able to really calmly consider what is the most elevated course and how can I go? How do you get there? Like about like this. But no matter how long it takes to get from here to there, when you're there, you're going to want to be there. And every little bit of choice that you make in the direction of true spiritual freedom is actually a much bigger step than you realize. Because as soon as we turn even our intention in an expanded direction, we're suddenly flowing with the river. And prior to that, we're always swimming upstream. As soon as we start to flow with the river, something completely other begins to happen. So it's not as Swamiji says that everything is miserable and then you're free. It's like every step of the way is a little better than the step before. People often ask me how, you know, what's the secret? How do you grow spiritually? And I don't have an answer. I've been seriously on this path for so many years. The only answer I can give is don't give up. I don't really know how it happens. It's not working. It's never working. Everything is a mess. You're just a complete basket case. You're doing everything wrong. And then somehow or another, you look back and you realize that you're not anymore. And all you did was just keep minute by minute, just making the best choice that you can. And even if it proved to be lousy, at least you were trying. And then that gradually just makes you somebody else, because we are a river seeking the sea. We are a bubble that's been thrown into the air that is going to come down again. There's just no way around it. As long as we just keep going, victory is assured. So, questions, comments, thoughts? Yes.
We
are fighting this thing all the time. If you think every religious epic is a war, I mean, every religious epic is a war.
That's not who I am, and I know that. Well,
it's not who you aspire to be, but there's something, and it's not how you define yourself, but there's a vibration within you that can be influenced. It comes in when you're weak.
When I'm conscious again, I go, wait a minute.
Right.
To be
but think of it more like this. I mean, I don't really, let me think how to say this. One of my own personal favorite expressions, but you have to understand I say this lightly, the devil made me do it. I really like that, because then it explains why I would do something so contrary to my own values, why I would get carried away. But the truth of this is, and this is very metaphysical and it's actually extremely interesting, the karma is stored in the chakras in magnetic whirlpools of energy. Vrittis is the Sanskrit word. It's whirlpools of energy. And you know, you see, chakra means wheel. And when you, every time you do or say anything, whatever vibration of consciousness that represents, that energy stays with you and is stored in your chakras. And those chakras become literally like a whirlpool, like a river running, and the water of the river gets pulled into that whirlpool. So we're on our way to say something really considered and sensible, and then all of a sudden our energy just gets sucked into that whirlpool, and we're saying something that's impulsive and not really what we meant to say. And that's past karma. That's past habit. That's the subconscious mind. There's lots of different words for that. And the only way to get out of that is, one, is to resist it mightily, but also any effort we make to increase the flow of the river, which when we start talking about meditation or spiritual practice, is to raise energy to the spiritual eye and make the flow through the spine just straight up and down more and more powerful. Then if you think about a river, there's a dynamic between the ability of the water to go off into a whirlpool and the ability of the river to resist that. And there's a point at which when the river gets strong enough, the whirlpool gets sucked into the river, and then you're not inclined to fall off in that direction anymore. So the only thing that you can do is resist as mightily as you can, rectify your error and acknowledge it as soon as you notice, and then actively do those things that continue to expand your consciousness and strengthen you in your relationship to the vibrations you really want to receive. So the feeling of the devil pulling on you is partly the fact that there is a cosmic force. There's a cosmic force pulling us toward the light, and there's a cosmic force pulling us away from the light. But you can also individualize that and see it as merely the vrittis of wrong habits and wrong actions that you yourself have created that are at war within us. That's why we get up in the morning and I think I'll just go sit down and meditate, but first let me see what emails I have. Bang, like that. And then while I'm here, I might as well see what people have posted on Facebook. Oh my, look, it's 9 o'clock. I guess I better go do something else. Just right within you, poof, like that, every time. And every time you go with it, then you add energy to that whirlpool, and then it makes it easier to keep going there. That's called addiction, whatever it is. I mean, however major or minor it is. So, and every time you resist and go this way, then you build a new vritti. So it's all metaphysics. It's all a dynamic interrelationship of the energy that you yourself have built up, plus the grace of God, which is the wild card in the whole thing, which is great. The way Yogananda puts it is that he can't break his own law. And if you yourself have built up so much energy in one direction, okay, think of it like this. He can't just change the laws, the natural laws. Karma is a natural law. And even our own desire, it's like if you're going very fast down the freeway and you wanted to go to that exit, but you miss that exit, you may want to turn around, but there's a tremendous amount of momentum going this way, and it takes a while to turn it. So our desire, when you really don't want to do something anymore, you don't do it. And if you keep doing it, it's because you haven't really quite figured out the effort to restrain it still seems like more work than the effort to give into it. And you have to just be honest enough to admit that. That's why I love somebody. When I had a really lousy attitude about something, and I was appealing to a healer friend of mine, she just looked at me and she said, "And so how is that working for you?" And it was actually a really good question, because when I answered it, I saw all the ways in which I was continuing to feed the wrong side of it, because a part of me just still wanted to. And when you don't want to anymore, you don't. You may be trying to turn the car around, trying to get back to the exit you missed, but you have to realize that I'm just not ready. It's in the commentaries on the Patanjali Yoga Sutras, actually. Swamiji writes that God could just take away the karma, but he almost never does, because we ourselves have to earn that freedom. You know, this is not a free ride. We dug the hole. We have to fill it in. It's very impersonal. God's grace comes in, and well, it's very hard to quantify. But if you stick with it long enough, this is where my sort of completely loony explanation comes in, and it's the only way I can say it. You work as hard as you can, day after day. You crash and burn innumerable times. You pick yourself up. You manage to just get over the embarrassment and the despair, and you dry your tears, and you get yourself going. You do that. Well, I've done it for 45 years. That's how long I've done it. And then you realize that you've completely changed, and that God's grace has changed you. So, I don't know. When you become different, you realize that it wasn't your doing. But I also know that if you don't just keep scrabbling to try to change, God's grace won't come in either. This is, most people are not actually trying to be changed, they're trying to be rescued. You see the big difference? To be rescued is I'm just going to sit here and whimper and then hope somebody will rescue me. It's different than saying, well, I'm going to die trying, and then finally you'll be plucked out. Remember that story, the incredible story about that man who cut off his own arm when he was locked with the rock there? That was such a story, wasn't it? He was just there for so long, and he couldn't figure out what to do, and he finally thought, oh, I can just leave my arm behind. And he just did then. He just left his arm behind, which was a pretty wild decision. But he just waited to be rescued for a really long time, and then he saw he wasn't going to be rescued, so he just had to do something about it. So it's a very good story for our whole reality. Okay, any other questions? Okay, Ivan?
Oh, thank you. You answered my question several different ways.
Okay.
So sometimes I teach seminars and people find the joy as if I know the topic.
Mm-hmm.
When
I was 22 and I met Swamiji and I threw my lot in with Ananda, I didn't know that I would still be here. all these years later. Because even though at that young age, I had already exhausted a number of options that were supposed to last longer than they did, that they just didn't feed me in the way that I'd hoped. But once I really started seriously down the spiritual path, in which the goal is infinity, it's just a never-ending series of experiences in which I grew up in El Paso, Texas, and we had to get anywhere from El Paso, you had to drive hours and hours across this flat, featureless desert. And the only thing interesting on those roads was the water mirage that you get out in the sun like that, where it's always right there. And I have a very vivid childhood memory of staring at that water mirage and urging my daddy to drive just a little faster because this time we could catch it. And he was so sweet. He would always try, and we'd try one more time to catch the mirage, but it was always... But I feel that since I came to the idea of self-realization, that the delight of it is that it's always in front of me, and I can just keep speeding toward it. And the fact that it keeps moving back is that my understanding of it keeps expanding. And I think that I've captured my own little piece of it, and I have. I'm a completely different person than I used to be. I mean, in countless ways I can quantify that. But the fun of it is that as soon as you get to one milestone, you realize that that just gives you the view of the next one. And so it's endlessly fascinating with marvelous experiences along the way. That's what I was saying. It's not like it's all desert and then it's all oasis. It's like everything just moves and you become freer and freer. And you literally find, because you see, as the river flows more strongly, the river is more powerful in relation to the whirlpools, or the whirlpools have been dissolved, you literally find that the exact same thing happens and you respond completely differently. Because it doesn't matter what happens to you, it only matters what you become. And that which used to just completely confuse or confound or cause you to suffer so much, you just say, look at that. And you see it exactly the same. It's not like you're blind. It's not like you become an airhead and you can't tell what's going on around you. It's just that you just see it different. You understand their part, somebody else's part in it. You understand the karmic part that you have, whatever it might be. Just a completely different reality. Freedom. That's the word we're talking about. Any other questions? Or yes?
On the spiritual journey, how do you know if you're progressing, advancing, or regressing?
I actually think freedom is exactly the right word for telling whether you're progressing. You feel freer in your heart. You feel less frightened of everything. You feel more confident when difficulties come. You feel more able to choose right actions, right energy, right responses. And all of those things are extremely tangible. Not everyone has big experiences almost nothing of out of the ordinary has ever happened to me. You know, no lights, no flashing lights, no visions, no nothing. I meditate steadily, but you know, my meditations are no circus, nothing goes on. But I'm consistently able to choose happiness in a way that I simply couldn't before. I have the freedom to decide what my response to life is going to be. And if you think about that, that's a lot. And that is what the spiritual path gives you, is an increasing capacity to be free of compulsion and to not be compelled, but to decide. You still experience just the same. You still go through just the same. Your heart can still be broken just the same. But you still have a certain freedom about how you're going to respond to that. Does that make sense? Somebody asked Swamiji, "Are you a happy man?" He said, "Everybody says they're happy because most people don't want to admit they're not." He said, "But it's the nature of true happiness to want to make everyone in the world as happy as you are." And Swami said, "By that criteria, I'm a very happy man." Because he's dedicated his life to making everyone as happy as he could. There's too much to hold, you want to tell everyone. And that's another sign of spiritual progress, is you realize you're really onto something. And the desire to give it to others just increases. And doesn't mean that you do what I do. It can be just you see someone in your own family who's sad and you just really want to help them. Your heart gets bigger. Yeah, you go through adolescence, spiritual adolescence, childhood and adolescence. Is that sufficient answer?
Yes.
There's a specific paragraph in the Swami's commentary on the Bhagavad Gita. Expansion of, sympathy and compassion for others, calmness, and inner joy. I mean, he has four. I can't remember what the fourth one was, but those are what he describes. Is this is how you can tell whether you're going forward or back. I could probably open the book and show you because I was just giving a class on it the other day. But it was exactly that question. What are the signs of? And it's listed right there. It's right in the first chapters of that book. I think that's enough for tonight. Oh, excuse me, you had one more. Yes.
Can you differentiate between suppressing, expressing your anger towards somebody that has hurt you and,
You mustn't misunderstand. Spirituality is not being nice. Spirituality is being authentic and sincere and appropriate. Okay? Now, authentic, sincere, and appropriate, and the best good for everybody involved includes you. And this is a mistake people make. They think everybody's more important than me. And that's just a reverse of egotism. To think I'm more important than everyone is a distortion. And to think I have no value and everybody else has value is an equal distortion. The fact of the matter is, in the eyes of the divine, we're all equal. So in any particular situation, if you're not able to transcend your negative feelings, and the only choice you have is to suppress them, your well-being also has to be taken into account. And you have to balance the fact that the more you express these things, the more the habit becomes that you will, versus what will happen to me if I'm not able to transcend it, but I only suppress it, and then it goes underground and makes everything a mess anyway. Even in the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna says to Arjuna, these are his words, what will it serve you to suppress yourself? Of what avail is suppression, he says.
You know, that person continued to annoy you, and then you just say...
Right. But that doesn't mean... I've always balanced it. Suppression is when you are afraid of something and you're afraid to own it, to face it, so instead you try to pretend it's not there. That's what suppression is. That's not the same as conscious self-discipline. Conscious self-discipline is to say, I have this feeling, I could say it, but the consequences, I don't want those consequences, so I'm just not going to do it. No, it won't make you sick. It'll make you very healthy. But you have to do it authentically, sincerely, and fearlessly. You know, I mean, speaking of marriage, for example, which I have, there was a point at which I realized that, you know, it was not getting me what I wanted to always be telling my husband what I thought he ought to do. He made it very clear to me that this was not a lifestyle. Okay? And my intentions were good. I thought if I kept explaining to him how and in what way he needed to change, that he would. And then I saw, number one, it was not working.
Purging, right?
No, it wasn't that. I actually genuinely thought it was helpful. I was just stupid, you know. But still, some things that he did, I didn't like. I wanted it to be different. So I had to ask myself, if I have to live the rest of my life and he's always like this, would I still rather live with him than without him? And so I had the phrase in my mind, is this worth breaking up the marriage over? And that just became my criteria. If it wasn't worth breaking up the marriage, then it wasn't worth causing a scene over. And now sometimes I had to walk out of the room. Sometimes I had to get out of the car. I mean, you know, please stop the car, I'll walk home, really. Because, you know, self-discipline did not come naturally. But I was able to make a conscious choice. I'm not going to do this. And no, it didn't make me sick at all. It made me very, very healthy. Because it was all very conscious. Suppression is angry. I'm not angry. Why would I be angry? I'm not a person that gets angry. Everything you do just is just wonderful to you. It doesn't bother me at all. That's what makes you sick. Ned, excuse me, honey. Would you stop the car? I have to get out right now. I'll regret what I'm going to say. Just, you know, yes. Okay, bye-bye. I'll see you. I'll take the bus. Yes. Okay,
I'm was appropriate.
Oh, appropriate? authentic, sincere, and appropriate. I would add to that, that it creates the greatest good for the greatest number. But I mean, not harmony and ease and escape from conflict, but the greatest real good for the greatest number, which includes you. You know? And sometimes your authentic, sincere, appropriate statement that this is outrageous and I will not put up with this is the most appropriate thing that can be said in that moment.
Because it looks like you are a pushover.
No. Being a pushover is, Swamiji just said, when somebody tries to take your rights away from you, why should you let them? Just why should you? If you're being bullied by somebody, why should you let him bully you? What is the value in that? You know, it doesn't. You are also important. Yeah. All right, great souls. Thank you very much. Happy holiday to you. If you have any further questions, I'm happy to stay, but this is our official end point.